Attention listeners, AfterSight's annual hike is coming up on July 27th.
It was a really good experience for me.
Visit aftersight.org/hike and become an audio trekker today.
That hike today gave me so much courage.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for this April 19th Friday reading of the Loveland News. My name is Pratima Sampat-Mar. Today we will be reading the following main articles: New Bill Sending $24 Million to Help Schools by Elizabeth Hernandez, Renovation of Historic Feed and Grain Building Nears Completion by Jocelyn Rowley, Danish Company Wins Incentives Offer by Lucas High, Judge Places Oldenburg Bankruptcy on Hold by Kenna Munson, Biannual Used Book Sale Returns to the Ranch by Will Costello, Johnstown Annexes Site Across from Johnson's Corner by Kenna Munson, and following up with miscellaneous articles. New Bill Sending $24 Million to Help Schools by Elizabeth Hernandez. Colorado will distribute $24 million in one-time funding to public school districts and charter schools impacted by the unprecedented influx of immigrant students who arrived after the annual October headcount that determines districts' state funding. Governor Jared Polis on Thursday signed the bipartisan bill HB24-1389, authorizing that money to be distributed this fiscal year from the State Education Fund. The Colorado Department of Education now will determine how much school districts receive using a multi-tiered funding model that's based on how many new-to-the-country students they enrolled following the count. What is going on now really has been quite substantial and unusual in terms of scope, and these thousands of new students coming requiring services, said Representative Emily Sirota, a Denver Democrat who helped sponsor the legislation. It is our obligation still to make sure everybody entering our public schools are getting an education. There is a need for more paraprofessionals, more teachers, more English language services, more wraparound services. Denver has borne the brunt of the impacts of newly arriving immigrants. Nearly 42,000 immigrants have arrived in the Mile High City in a little more than a year, according to city records updated this week. Thousands of new students have enrolled in Denver public schools over the past several months, past the deadline that provides per-pupil funding to state school districts. In Denver, that per-pupil funding amounts to about $11,000 per student per year. In February, DPS said the district had enrolled 1,900 new students outside of the October count, leaving it short more than $20 million in state funding. Bill Good, a DPS spokesperson on Thursday, said the state's largest school district anticipates receiving between $3 million and $5 million from the new funding bill. Denver Public Schools joined school districts across the state in thanking the Colorado legislature and Governor Jared Polis in passing and signing HB24-1389. Scott Pribble, another DPS spokesperson, said, "This additional funding will help our district continue to support our newcomer students as they thrive in Denver Public Schools." "The money will be distributed before the end of the school year," Sirota said. "We felt it was important to provide some additional resources in this school year to meet those pressing needs we see not only on the Front Range, but even in some of our mountain communities and rural communities as well," she said. The funding distribution mechanism accounts for students who transfer to other school districts as well to ensure there is no double dipping on per-pupil funding, Sirota said. "This bipartisan law helps ensure school districts receive the funding they need to educate students where they are currently attending school," Polis said in a statement. "I applaud the Joint Budget Committee for their work on this legislation, and I am happy to sign it into law to help more schools and educators get the resources they need." Renovation of Historic Feed and Grain Building Nears Completion by Jocelyn Rowley. A Loveland architectural landmark that was once just a city council vote away from demolition is embarking on a new chapter. On Wednesday, city staff and officials got a sneak peek at the newly renovated Loveland Feed and Grain Building as construction nears completion on the mixed-use conversion project. "To see this come to fruition is absolutely incredible," said Marcy Willard, the city's acting economic development director, who has been involved with the project for more than a decade. "Loveland should be proud of everybody coming together to see it happen." The three-story building, currently known as Loveland Feed and Grain, is currently nearly as old as the city itself. It was constructed at 310 West 3rd Street between 1891 and 1892, replacing another mill on the site that was destroyed by a fire. Over the next several years, the building was expanded to accommodate a coal-fired power plant that provided electricity to the mill as well as downtown Loveland. An office and warehouse were also added, increasing the structure to nearly 30,000 square feet. The Feed and Grain served as Loveland's main mill until 2003, when it was closed by the owners. In the 21 years since, it has changed hands a few times as its fate was being decided. In 2006, the building received an historic landmark designation and was purchased by longtime Loveland developer Barry Floyd after a grassroots campaign to save it from redevelopment plans that included demolition of the main structure. After a few false starts, Floyd then sold the building to nonprofit developer Arts Space Projects Incorporated in 2014 for conversion into affordable rental and commercial space tailored to the art community. Crews were still putting the finishing touches on the 9 residential and 4 commercial units, now gracing the space on Wednesday, but all of the major work is done, according to principal architect Gabe Bergeron, another long-timer on the project. The residences are on the west side of the building and retain many of the markings of their former purpose as grain bins, including rough plank walls, original brickwork, heavy wooden beams, and in a few cases, old mill furnishings and machinery or vintage signage. Our hope was to reveal the space and pull out the quality of the grain bin walls and the volume of the space, Bergeron said. We've been pretty raw with restoration of existing materials and then just a couple of new insertions, which are the kitchens and bathrooms. Around 6,000 square feet has been segmented into 4 studios for commercial leasing on the east side of the building, where sacks of grain or flour were once stored prior to shipment. Though not quite as rustic as the residential units, the spaces are also dotted with original details, including sliding barn doors and original flooring. The building also includes a communal hall in the former boiler room that could host future community events. After the tour, Bergeron praised general contractor Spectrum and their subcontractors for their careful craftsmanship on the project, calling it part of what makes it sing. He also called the renovation one of his favorite projects, despite surprises that included uneven walls and floors, unexpected damage to finishes, and less pleasantly, animal remains and droppings. It's just such an amazing cultural project, the architect said. It has all of this history of the region embedded in its nature. And then to be able to infuse that with creative, artistic people, that's a cool cultural combination. And as an architect, it's exciting because on the one hand, how do you reveal the character of the old mill, he continued, and on the other hand, how do you make it also feel like an exciting, creative space that's full of light? Though construction is wrapping up, it will be another few months before the units will be available for new tenants. The residential units have an affordable designation and will be offered for rent to households earning less than 120% of the area median income. The commercial spaces will be offered at the market rate. For more information about the project, visit artspace.org/Loveland. Danish company wins incentives offer by Lucas High. The Colorado Economic Development Commission extended a multi-million-dollar tax incentive offer on Thursday to an unidentified foreign wind turbine company that is eyeing Larimer County for a new manufacturing facility. The company, referred to by staff with Colorado Office of Economic Development and International Trade staff as Project Saffron, is a Danish company that supplies ready-to-use structural materials and composite parts for wind turbine blades, as well as logistical and engineering solutions for its clients. OEDIT, Deputy Director and Director of Global Business Development Michelle Hadwiger said. Project Saffron, which has 400 employees, 200 of whom are in Colorado, is seeking to open a manufacturing system in the U.S. to enable better and more cost-effective logistics and services for their primary client, a Colorado-based company in the wind energy sector, according to OEDIT. The company's decision for where it ultimately locates will be predicated on proximity to its clientele and supply chain, relative cost of commercial freight, and local incentives. A Project Saffron representative identified during the EDC meeting as Soren said that the company is an international company operating in renewable energy, and our expansion into the U.S. is of strategic importance to our company. We have assessed a number of states and locations, and we find Colorado attractive. In addition to Larimer County, Project Saffron is considering Wyoming and South Carolina for its new manufacturing plant. We look forward to building a local supply chain together with local workplaces and as such the basis for local tax contribution, Soren said. To entice Project Saffron, Colorado is offering nearly $3.4 million in tax incentives over 8 years. Should the company accept, it would need to create 210 net new jobs and an average annual wage of $78,230 to receive the full amount. The jobs will include managers, engineers, technicians, human resources, and administrative roles, according to OEDIT, which said in a memo that the project would support the state's economic goals by supporting Colorado's wind energy industry by situating a Tier 1 supply chain operator within the state's borders, and by supporting foreign direct investment in an important industry vertical in Colorado's advanced manufacturing sector. Northern Colorado is already home to a Danish wind turbine manufacturing operation. The American business of Danish wind turbine maker Vestas Wind Systems AS, which shares some similarities with Project Saffron, has plants in Windsor and Brighton. Vestas, a representative of which did not respond to a request from BizWest Thursday morning to confirm whether it is indeed Project Saffron, said last summer that it will invest $40 million in upgrades at those existing facilities, where it plans to build a new turbine project for the United States market, the V163-4.5MW, which is optimized for low to medium wind speeds. To support the new turbine production, Vestas said in 2023 that it planned to hire between 800 and 1,000 new workers between the Windsor and Brighton plants. The new investment is a significant turnaround from 2021, when Vestas laid off about 450 workers across its operations in Brighton and Pueblo. It has since sold its Pueblo Tower manufacturing plant. Judge places Oldenburg bankruptcy on hold, by Kenna Munson. U.S. Bankruptcy Court Judge Joseph Rosenio will not confirm the reorganization plan, the fourth, filed by Sandra and Lee Oldenburg. Instead, he decided Thursday to place the bankruptcy on hold until after civil and potentially criminal matters are resolved. The Oldenburgs, who live in Johnstown, filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy protection in August 2023. Lee Oldenburg is a teacher in the Windsor School District, and Sandra Oldenburg is the former co-owner of a property management company based in Fort Collins. Carlson Farms Homeowners Association filed an adversary court case claiming that hundreds of thousands of dollars were missing from HOA bank accounts, accounts that Sandra Oldenburg managed. Subsequently, other HOAs managed by Oldenburg and her company, NoCo Real Estate Solutions Inc., which has done business as Pudra Property Services, also reported the potential of missing money or at least the inability to get an accounting of their affairs. Thursday, attorney Rob Cohen, who represents Carlson Farms, said that the HOA continues to object on the basis of feasibility of the repayment plan and whether the bankruptcy was filed in good faith. I'm getting calls from other HOAs who were not noticed on the bankruptcy proceedings. Cohen said one of them, Rolling Hills HOA, claims to be owed more than $140,000, which is not listed in the bankruptcy as a creditor. A civil case on the Carlson Farms complaint is scheduled for October, and if Carlson is successful, if the confirmation is approved, then Carlson Farms would not be able to collect for 5 years, he said. Cohen said he has not had an opportunity to conduct discovery in the case, but he has conducted some tracing. Some funds were transferred to the spouse's father, he said, which has meant that the civil case was expanded to include another defendant. Cohen also said that a criminal investigation is ongoing and, quote, that adds another level of complication, unquote. David Serafin, attorney for the Oldenburg, said he was not aware of the status of the criminal investigation other than he thought no charges had been brought at this point. Serafin told the court that he needed to amend Schedule D of the reorganization plan to add the Rolling Hills unsecured claim. Rosania, in leading up to his decision to delay confirming the plan, said that the case presents, quote, a lot of moving parts, unquote, and that, quote, waiting for the state court makes sense, unquote. He said that if other HOAs have claims, they need to file a proof of claim with the bankruptcy court, and they would need to hire legal counsel to file motions asking the court to accept the late claims because claim filings were due no later than November 6, 2023. Deanne Menzies, president of the Rolling Hills Ranch Patio 2 HOA, and Diane Morris, representing the Rolling Hills Ranch Master HOA, said they have claims but lack the ability to pay an attorney because our money is gone. We are cooperating with a detective on the criminal side, Menzies said. As many as 13 HOAs have become aware of the bankruptcy action, and 10 of them are cooperating on the potential criminal side, she said. Verzania said that he had serious concerns about the case and had considered dismissing the bankruptcy, but instead would stay the confirmation until after the civil and potentially criminal actions are resolved. The judge said that the bankruptcy plan as outlined would allow repayment of about $50,000 in overdue income taxes, but any unsecured creditors would have to wait at least 4 years to see any repayment. He noted there were unsecured claims of $1.7 million, including $1.2 million from Carlson Farms, and an unknown amount from other creditors who had not filed claims because they were not aware of the bankruptcy case deadlines. He said the plan permits payment of, quote, less than 0.02%, unquote, of existing unsecured claims, an amount that would be reduced by attorney fees. I disagree with the debtor's counsel that this is the debtors trying to save their house and pay income taxes, the judge said. An email sent to Serafin was not acknowledged prior to publication time. The cases are Carlson Farms Homeowners Association versus NoCo Real Estate Solutions, Inc. and Sandra Oldenburg. Case number 2023 CV-30125, filed February 17, 2023 in Larimer County District Court. Sandra Oldenburg and Lee Oldenburg, Chapter 13 Bankruptcy, case number 2023-13858, filed August 28, 2023 in U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Colorado. Biannual used book sale returns to the ranch. Proceeds benefit Loveland Public Library Programs, by Will Costello. The biannual Friends of the Loveland Public Library used book sale returns to town this weekend, giving bookworms access to a dizzying array of titles, most of which can be purchased for a dollar or two. Around 45,000 books are on offer at the McKee 4-H building at the Ranch Events Complex, and local readers can begin perusing the stack Saturday at 9 a.m. Members of the Friends of the Loveland Public Library, who make a yearly donation for special access to events, we'll have a first go at the rows and rows of books, DVDs, CDs, puzzles, and other bookstore ephemera Friday afternoon. Because the Friends take an everything-must-go approach to the event, Sunday will feature a book bag sale where shoppers can purchase a shopping bag for $5 and take home as many books as they can fit inside. We get so much in that we don't really want to or need to raise our prices, volunteer Debbie Kelly said Thursday morning while helping to set up the thousands of books that will soon be on sale. Kelly works in the vintage section of the book sale, carefully organizing and displaying decades-old volumes from the likes of Charles Dickens, Ernest Hemingway, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and J.R.R. Tolkien, as well as histories and even medical textbooks with endearingly worn covers and charming illustrations. But there are plenty more contemporary offerings available. Children's books will sell for as little as 50 cents, and true crime novels, self-help books, legal thrillers, and tomes on history and science are plentiful. There's something for everyone, said Friends of the Loveland Public Library board member Laura Stump. And that fact has created a surge of interest that nets roughly $35,000 per sale. Sales take place twice yearly in October and April, and proceeds go towards funding programs at the library that serve children, teens, and adults. Ruth McPherson is the category captain for Humor and Supernatural and Unexplained. The former is self-explanatory, but the latter includes books on topics ranging from alien encounters to communion with spirits to the predictions of Nostradamus. Everything from aliens to witchcraft, McPherson said with a grin. Johnstown Annexes Site Across from Johnson's Corner, by Kenna Munson. One of the most recognizable structures along North Interstate 25, the steep roof building east of the highway across from Johnson's Corner that old-timers will remember at one time housed a Stuckey's restaurant and pecan shop, has been annexed and rezoned in preparation for its redevelopment. The Johnstown Town Board voted to annex the 6-acre site and zone it I-1 from its Larimer County zoning of neighborhood commercial. The I-1 zoning permits light industrial uses, or, as suggested by the property's owners, it could be used for a convenience store gasoline stop. The property owners, Yellow Roof Development LLC, based in Santa Ana, California, plan to ultimately sell it to a convenience store developer, according to information provided to the Johnstown Planning and Development Department. Alex Hoym is the local project manager. Yellow Roof's California address is the same as two companies, Tate & Associates Civil Engineering and Environmental Services, which also has a Loveland office, and Booz Development, a company that works with national companies such as Starbucks, Circle K, Family Dollar, and others that want to open operations across the country. Its website says it has completed more than 1,200 projects, totaling 10 million square feet of space. The company does not have an active application for redevelopment of the site, said Jeremy Gleim, Johnstown's Director of Planning and Development. The 6-acre site with the 3,500 square foot building was last purchased in October of 2006 for $1.2 million. At that time, Brown's Corner LLP was the seller. The steep roofed structure on the site was built in 1968. A fire DPS spokesman alleges he faced harassment retaliation by Jessica Seaman. The former communications director, fired by Denver Public Schools in February, alleges in internal emails that he faced harassment and retaliation from district officials after filing a formal discrimination complaint last year. In March, emails obtained by the Denver Post, Will Jones told district officials that his, quote, tenure at Denver Public Schools was unfortunately marred by instances of racial discrimination, harassment, and subsequent retaliatory actions following my filing of a discrimination prevention and response complaint, unquote. Jones went on to say that despite his efforts to seek support from district leaders, including Superintendent Alex Marrero, the situation escalated, culminating in the elimination of my role and my termination on February 8, 2024. DPS spokesman Bill Good said the district did not terminate Jones's employment because of the discrimination complaint, but he could not comment on personnel matters. The findings of the subsequent third-party investigation into Jones's complaint have not been made public. In an interview, Jones said he lost his job after almost 9 years with DPS when the district restructured its communications team. He declined to discuss the nature of his discrimination complaint or say who he filed it against. When asked about what he said in emails to the district, he said, "I stand by it." Jones held a news conference Thursday at which he accused Colorado's largest district of not being transparent with parents, students, and school board members. He said he has deep concerns about the lack of accountability in the district and took aim at the Board of Education's governance model, saying it prevents DPS employees from communicating with board members about what is happening in the district. DPS said in a statement that under the board's governance model, members are not involved in the day-to-day operations of the district, as such responsibilities belong to Marrero. Instead, the board sets long-term goals for the district to achieve under the superintendent's leadership. The previous iteration of the board, through policy, agreed to limit its information requests to reduce the administrative burden on district staff and resources, the school board said in a statement Thursday evening. If the board ever believes it is not receiving the information it requires, the board may revisit and change this policy at any time. Jones also criticized DPS's use of confidentiality agreements, which employees in the communications department were asked to sign earlier this year. "I believe that information is a good thing," he said. "More information is better." DPS said in a statement that the confidential agreements do not prevent employees from speaking out about wrongdoing, as they are still protected under the federal whistleblower program. Denver Public Schools prioritizes the safeguarding of student and employee information, the district said in the statement. Numerous employees, including those in student services, human resources, legal, communications, and IT, require access to confidential data and sign NDAs to remind them of their obligations under privacy laws. In the emails between Jones and district officials, he alleged DPS violated his rights under the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act And as for 2 years of past wages and 4 years of future wages, which he said is in alignment with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Equal Protection Clause. DPS declined the settlement offer, according to the documents. Thank you for joining us for the Loveland News. My name is Pratima Sampat Mar.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.